scrambled eggs something. "Just the two of us," I confirmed with a smile, and nodded in appreciation as I took a mouthful of wobbly egg. "Seems lonely." On that, she was right. 4 months later, the whole big house lady lost her mortgage battle and disappeared in the night with her three kids. Her house has remained empty. The living room window still has a child's picture of a butterfly taped to it, the bright magic marker sun-faded to brown. One evening, not long ago, I drove past and saw a man, bearded, bedraggled, staring out from behind the picture, floating in the dark like some sad aquarium fish. He saw me see him and flickered back into the depths of the house. The next day I left a brown paper bag full of sandwiches on the front step. It sat in the sun untouched for a week, decaying wetly, until I picked it back up and threw it out. Quiet. The complex was always disturbingly quiet. As I neared our home, conscious of the noise of the car engine, I could see the cat was definitely on the steps. Still on the steps, 20 minutes after Carl's call. This was strange. Amy loved the cat. The cat was declawed. The cat was never let outside. Never, ever. Because the cat, Bleecker, was sweet but extremely stupid. And despite the LoJack tracking device pelleted somewhere in his fat, furry rolls, Amy knew she'd never see the cat again if he ever got out. The cat would waddle straight into the Mississippi River, deedle-dee-dum, and float all the way to the Gulf of Mexico into the maw of a hungry bull shark. But it turned out the cat wasn't even smart enough to get past the steps. Bleecker was perched on the edge of the porch, a pudgy but proud sentinel, Private Tryhard. As I pulled into the drive, Carl came out and stood on his own front steps, and I could feel the cat and the old man both watching me as I got out of the car and walked toward the house, the red peonies along the border looking fat and juicy, asking to be devoured. I was about to go into blocking position to get the cat when I saw that the front door was open. Carl had said as much, but seeing it was different. This wasn't taking out the trash back in a minute open. This was wide, gaping, ominous open. Carl hovered across the way, waiting for my response. And like some awful piece of performance art, I felt myself enacting concerned husband. I stood on the middle step and frowned, then took the stairs quickly, two at a time, calling out my wife's name. Silence. "Amy, you home?" I ran straight upstairs. No Amy. The ironing board was set up, the iron still on, a dress waiting to be pressed. "Amy!" As I ran back downstairs, I could see Carl still framed in the open doorway, hands on hips, watching. I swerved into the living room and pulled up short. The carpet glinted with shards of glass. The coffee table shattered. End tables were on their sides. Books slid across the floor like a card trick. Even the heavy antique ottoman was belly up, its four tiny feet in the air like something dead. In the middle of the mess was a pair of good sharp scissors. "Amy!" I began running, bellowing her name. Through the kitchen, where a tea kettle was burning, down to the basement, where the guest room stood empty, and then out the back door. I pounded across our yard onto the slender boat deck leading out over the river. I peeked over the side to see if she was in our rowboat, where I had found her one day, tethered to the dock, rocking in the water, her face to the sun, eyes closed, and as I had peered down into the dazzling reflections of the river, at her beautiful, still face, she'd suddenly opened her blue eyes and said nothing to me, and I'd said nothing back and gone into the house alone.
Amy!
She wasn't on the water. She wasn't in the house. Amy was not there. Amy was gone.
Amy Elliott, September 18th, 2005. Diary entry. Well, well, well. Guess who's back? Nick Dunn, Brooklyn party boy, sugar cloud kisser, disappearing act. 8 months, 2 weeks, couple of days, no word, and then he resurfaces, like it was all part of the plan. Turns out he'd lost my phone number. His cell was out of juice, so he'd written it on a sticky. Then he'd tucked the sticky into his jeans pocket and put the jeans in the washer, and it turned the sticky into a piece of cyclone-shaped pulp. He tried to unravel it, but could only see a 3 and an 8, he said. And then work clobbered him, and suddenly it was March, and too embarrassingly late to try to find me, he said. Of course, I was angry. I had been angry. But now I'm not. Let me set the scene, she said. Today, gusty September winds. I'm walking along 7th Avenue, making a lunchtime contemplation of the sidewalk bodega bins, endless plastic containers of cantaloupe and honeydew and melon perched on ice like the day's catch, and I could feel a man barnacling himself to my side as I sailed along, and I corner-eyed the intruder and realized who it was. It was him. The boy in I Met a Boy. I didn't break my stride, just turned to him and said, A, do I know you? Manipulative, challenging. B, oh, wow, I'm so happy to see you. Eager, doormat-like. C, go fuck yourself. Aggressive, bitter. D, well, you certainly take your time about it, don't you, Nick? Light, playful, laid back. Answer, D. And now we're together. Together, together. It was that easy. It's interesting, the timing. Propitious, if you will. And I will. Just last night was my parents' book party. Amazing Amy and the Big Day. Yep, Rand and Mary Beth couldn't resist. They've given their daughter's namesake what they can't give their daughter. A husband! Yes, for book 20, Amazing Amy is getting married! Whee! No one cares. No one wanted Amazing Amy to grow up, least of all me. Leave her in knee socks and hair ribbons and let me grow up, unencumbered by my literary alter ego, my paper-bound better half, the me I was supposed to be. But Amy is the Elliott bread and butter, and she's served us well, so I suppose I can't begrudge her a perfect match. She's marrying good old Abel Andy, of course. They'll be just like my parents. Happy, happy. Still, it was unsettling, the incredibly small order the publisher put in. A new Amazing Amy used to get a first print of 100,000 copies back in the 80s. Now, 10,000. The book launch party was, accordingly, unfabulous. Off tone. How do you throw a party for a fictional character who started life as a precocious moppet of 6 and is now a 30-year-old bride-to-be who still speaks like a child? Sheesh, thought Amy. My dear fiancé sure is a grouch monster when he doesn't get his way. That is an actual quote. The whole book made me want to punch Amy right in her stupid, spotless vagina. The book is a nostalgia item, intended to be purchased by women who grew up with Amazing Amy, but I'm not sure who will actually want to read it. I read it, of course. I gave the book my blessing. multiple times. Rand and Mary Beth feared that I might take Amy's marriage as some jab at my perpetually single state. I, for one, don't think women should marry before 35, said my mom, who married my dad at 23. My parents have always worried that I'd take Amy too personally. They always tell me not to read too much into her. And yet I can't fail to notice that whenever I screw something up, Amy does it right. When I finally quit violin at age 12, Amy was revealed as a prodigy in the next book.
Sheesh! Violin can be hard work, but hard work is the only way to get better.
When I blew off the junior tennis championship at age 16 to do a beach weekend with friends, Amy recommitted to the game.
Sheesh, I know it's fun to spend time with friends, but I'd be letting myself and everyone else down if I didn't show up for the tournament.
This used to drive me mad, but after I went off to Harvard, and Amy correctly chose my parents' alma mater, I decided it was all too ridiculous to think about. That my parents, two child psychologists, chose this particular public form of passive-aggressiveness toward their child was not just fucked up, but also stupid and weird and kind of hilarious. So be it. The book party was as schizophrenic as the book. At Blue Night, off Union Square, one of those shadowy salons with wingback chairs and art deco mirrors that are supposed to make you feel like a bright young thing. Gin martinis wobbling on trays lofted by waiters with rictus smiles. Greedy journalists with knowing smirks and hollow legs, getting the free buzz before they go somewhere better. My parents circulate the room hand in hand. Their love story is always part of the Amazing Amy story. Husband and wife in mutual creative labor for a quarter century. Soulmates. They really call themselves that, which makes sense because I guess they are. I can vouch for it, having studied them, little lonely only child, for many years. They have no harsh edges with each other, no spiny conflicts. They ride through life like conjoined jellyfish, expanding and contracting instinctively, filling each other's spaces liquidly. Making it look easy, the soulmate thing. People say children from broken homes have it hard, but the children of charmed marriages have their own particular challenges. Naturally, I have to sit on some velvety banquette in the corner of the room, out of the noise, so I can give a few interviews to a sad handful of kid interns who've gotten stuck with the grab-a-quote assignment from their editors. How does it feel to see Amy finally married to Andy? Because you're not married, right? Question asked by A. A sheepish, bug-eyed kid balancing a notebook on top of his messenger bag. B. An overdressed, sleek-haired young thing with fuck-me stilettos. C. An eager, tattooed rockabilly girl who seemed way more interested in Amy than one would guess a tattooed rockabilly girl would be. D. All of the above. Answer? D. Me. Oh, I'm thrilled for Amy and Andy. I wish them the best. Ha ha. My answers to all the other questions, in no particular order. Some parts of Amy are inspired by me, and some are just fiction. I'm happily single right now. No able Andy in my life. No, I don't think Amy oversimplifies the male-female dynamic. No, I wouldn't say Amy is dated. I think the series is a classic. Yes, I am single. No able Andy in my life right now. Why is Amy amazing and Andy's just able? Well, don't you know a lot of powerful, fabulous women who settle for regular guys, average Joes and able Andys? No, just kidding. Don't write that. Yes, I am single. Yes, my parents are definitely soulmates. Yes, I would like that for myself one day. Yep, single, motherfucker. Same questions over and over, and me trying to pretend they're thought-provoking. And them trying to pretend they're thought-provoking. Thank God for the open bar. Then no one else wants to talk to me. That fast. And the PR girl pretends it's a good thing. Now you can get back to your party. I wriggle back into the small crowd, where my parents are in full hosting mode, their faces flushed. Rand with his toothy, prehistoric monster fish smile. Mary Beth with her chickeny, cheerful head bobs, their hands intertwined, making each other laugh, enjoying each other, thrilled with each other. And I think, I am so fucking lonely. I go home and cry for a while. I am almost 32. That's not old, especially not in New York, but fact is, it's been years since I even really liked someone. So how likely is it I'll meet someone I love, much less someone I love enough to marry? I'm tired of not knowing who I'll be with, or if I'll be with anyone. I have many friends who are married. Not many who are happily married, but many married friends. The few happy ones are like my parents. They're baffled by my singleness. A smart, pretty, nice girl like me, a girl with so many interests and enthusiasms, a cool job, a loving family, and, let's say it, money. They knit their eyebrows and pretend to think of men they can set me up with, but we all know there's no one left, no one good left. And I know that they secretly think there's something wrong with me, something hidden away that makes me unsatisfiable, unsatisfying. The ones who are not soulmated, the ones who have settled, are even more dismissive of my singleness. It's not that hard to find someone to marry, they say. No relationship is perfect, they say. They, who make do with dutiful sex and gassy bedtime rituals, who settle for TV as conversation, who believe that husbandly capitulation, yes, honey, okay, honey, is the same as concord. He's doing what you tell him to do because he doesn't care enough to argue, I think. Your petty demands simply make him feel superior or resentful. And someday he will fuck his pretty young coworker who asks nothing of him, and you will actually be shocked. Give me a man with a little fight in him, a man who calls me on my bullshit, but who also kind of likes my bullshit. And yet, don't land me in one of those relationships where we're always pecking at each other, disguising insults as jokes, rolling our eyes and, playfully, scrapping in front of our friends, hoping to lure them to our side of an argument they could not care less about. Those awful, if-only, relationships. This marriage would be great if only... And you sense the if-only list is a lot longer than either of them realizes. So I know I am right not to settle, but it doesn't make me feel better as my friends pair off and I stay home on Friday night with a bottle of wine and make myself an extravagant meal and tell myself, this is perfect, as if I'm the one dating me. As I go to endless rounds of parties and bar nights, perfumed and sprayed and hopeful, rotating myself around the room like some dubious dessert, I go on dates with men who are nice and good-looking and smart. Perfect on paper men who make me feel like I'm in a foreign land, trying to explain myself, trying to make myself known. Because isn't that the point of every relationship? To be known by someone else? To be understood? He gets me. She gets me. Isn't that the simple magic phrase? So, you suffer through the night with the perfect on-paper man, the stutter of jokes misunderstood, the witty remarks lobbed and missed. Or maybe he understands that you've made a witty remark, but unsure of what to do with it, he holds it in his hand like some bit of conversational phlegm he will wipe away later. You spend another hour trying to find each other, to recognize each other. And you drink a little too much and try a little too hard. And you go home to a cold bed and think, that was fine. And your life is a long line of fine. And then you run into Nick Dunn on 7th Avenue as you're buying diced cantaloupe and pow, you are known. You are recognized, the both of you. You both find the exact same things worth remembering. Just one olive, though. You have the same rhythm. Click. You just know each other. All of a sudden, you see reading in bed, and waffles on Sunday, and laughing at nothing, and his mouth on yours. And it's so far beyond fine that you know you can never go back to fine. That fast. You think, oh, here is the rest of my life. It's finally arrived.
Nick Dunn, the day of. I waited for the police first in the kitchen, but the acrid smell of the burnt tea kettle was curling up in the back of my throat, underscoring my need to retch. So I drifted out on the front porch, sat on the top stair, and willed myself to be calm. I kept trying Amy's cell, and it kept going to voicemail. That quick clip cadence swearing she'd phone right back. Amy always phoned right back. It had been 3 hours, and I'd left 5 messages, and Amy had not phoned back. I didn't expect her to. I'd tell the police Amy would never have left the house with the tea kettle on, or the door open, or anything waiting to be ironed. The woman got shit done, and she was not one to abandon a project, say her fixer-upper husband, for instance, even if she decided she didn't like it. She'd made a grim figure on the Fiji beach during our 2-week honeymoon, battling her way through 1 million mystical pages of the Wind-Up Bird Chronicle, casting pissy glances at me as I devoured thriller after thriller. Since our move back to Missouri, the loss of her job, her life had revolved, devolved, around the completion of endless, tiny, inconsequential projects. The dress would have been ironed. And there was the living room, signs pointing to a struggle. I already knew Amy wasn't phoning back. I wanted the next part to start. It was the best time of day, the July sky cloudless, the slowly setting sun a spotlight on the east, turning everything golden and lush, a Flemish painting. The police rolled up. It felt casual, me sitting on the steps, an evening bird singing in the tree, these two cops getting out of their car at a leisurely pace, as if they were dropping by a neighborhood picnic. Kid cops, mid-20s, confident and uninspired, accustomed to soothing worried parents of curfew-busting teens. A Hispanic girl, her hair in a long dark braid, and a black guy with a marine stance. Carthage had become a bit, a very tiny bit, less Caucasian while I was away, but it was still so severely segregated that the only people of color I saw in my daily routine tended to be occupational roamers, delivery men, medics, postal workers, cops. "This place is so white, it's disturbing," said Amy, who, back in the melting pot of Manhattan, counted a single African-American among her friends. I accused her of craving ethnic window dressing, minorities as backdrops. It did not go well. "Mr. Dunn, I'm Officer Velasquez," said the woman. "And this is Officer Reardon. We understand you're concerned about your wife." Reardon looked down the road, sucking on a piece of candy. I could see his eyes following a darting bird out over the river. Then he snapped his gaze back toward me, his curled lips telling me he saw what everyone else did. I have a face you want to punch. I'm a working-class Irish kid trapped in the body of a total trust fund douchebag. I smile a lot to make up for my face, but this only sometimes works. In college, I even wore glasses for a bit, fake spectacles with clear lenses that I thought would lend me an affable, unthreatening vibe. You do realize that makes you even more of a dick? Go reasoned. I threw them out and smiled harder. I waved in the cops. Come inside the house and see. The two climbed the steps, accompanied by the squeaking and shuffling noises of their belts and guns. I stood in the entry to the living room and pointed at the destruction. Oh, said Officer Reardon, and gave a brisk crack of his knuckles. He suddenly looked less bored. Reardon and Velasquez leaned forward in their seats at the dining room table as they asked me all the initial questions. Who, where, how long? Their ears were literally pricked. A call had been made, out of my hearing, and Reardon informed me that detectives were being dispatched. I had the grave pride of being taken seriously. Reardon was asking me for the second time if I'd seen any strangers in the neighborhood lately, was reminding me for the third time about Carthage's roving bands of homeless men, when the phone rang. I launched myself across the room and grabbed it. A surly woman's voice. Mr. Dunn, this is Comfort Hill Assisted Living. It was where Go and I boarded our Alzheimer's-riddled father. I can't talk right now. I'll call you back, I snapped, and hung up. I despised the women who staffed Comfort Hill, unsmiling, uncomforting, underpaid, gruelingly underpaid, which was probably why they never smiled or comforted. I knew my anger toward them was misdirected. It absolutely infuriated me that my father lingered on while my mom was in the ground. It was Go's turn to send the check. I was pretty sure it was Go's turn for July, and I'm sure she was positive it was mine. We'd done this before. Go said we must be mutually subliminally forgetting to mail those checks, that what we really wanted to forget was our dad. I was telling Reardon about the strange man I'd seen in our neighbor's vacated house when the doorbell rang. The doorbell rang. It sounded so normal, like I was expecting a pizza. The two detectives entered with end-of-shift weariness. The man was rangy and thin, with a face that tapered severely into a dribble of a chin. The woman was surprisingly ugly, brazenly, beyond the scope of everyday ugly, tiny round eyes set tight as buttons, a long twist of a nose, skin spackled with tiny bumps, long, lank hair the color of a dust bunny. I have an affinity for ugly women. I was raised by a trio of women who were hard on the eyes, my grandmother, my mom, her sister, and they were all smart and kind and funny and sturdy, good, good women. Amy was the first pretty girl I ever dated, really dated. The ugly woman spoke first, an echo of Miss Officer Velasquez. Mr. Dunn, I'm Detective Rhonda Boney. This is my partner, Detective Jim Gilpin. We understand there are some concerns about your wife. My stomach growled loud enough for us all to hear it, but we pretended we didn't. We take a look around, sir, Gilpin said. He had fleshy bags under his eyes and scraggly white whiskers in his mustache. His shirt wasn't wrinkled, but he wore it like it was. He looked like he should stink of cigarettes and sour coffee, even though he didn't. He smelled like Dial soap. I led them a few short steps to the living room, pointed once again at the wreckage, where the two younger cops were kneeling carefully, as if waiting to be discovered doing something useful. Boney steered me toward a chair in the dining room, away from, but in view of, the signs of struggle. Rhonda Boney walked me through the same basics I'd told Velasquez and Reardon, her attentive sparrow eyes on me. Gilpin squatted down on a knee, assessing the living room. "Have you phoned friends or family? People your wife might be with?" Rhonda Boney asked.
No, not yet. I guess I was waiting for you all."
"Ah," she smiled. "Let me guess. Baby of the family."
"What?"
"You're the baby." "I have a twin sister." I sensed some internal judgment being made.
"Why?"
Amy's favorite vase was lying on the floor, intact, bumped up against the wall. It was a wedding present, a Japanese masterwork that Amy put away each week when our house cleaner came because she was sure it would get smashed.
"Just a guess of mine, why you'd wait for us. You're used to someone else always taking the lead," Boney said. "That's what my little brother is like. It's a birth order thing."
She scribbled something on a notepad.
"Okay."
I gave an angry shrug.
"Do you need my son signed too, or can we get started?"
Boney smiled at me kindly, waiting. "I waited to do something because, I mean, she's obviously not with a friend," I said, pointing at the disarray in the living room.
"You've lived here, what, Mr. Dunn? 2 years?"
she asked. 2 years, September.
"Moved from where?"
"New York."
"City?"
"Yes." She pointed upstairs, asking permission without asking, and I nodded and followed her, Gilpin following me.
"I was a writer there,"
I blurted out before I could stop myself. Even now, 2 years back here, and I couldn't bear for someone to think this was my only life.
Boney: "Sounds impressive."
Gilpin: "Of what?"
I timed my answer to my stair climbing. "I wrote for a magazine," step. "I wrote about pop culture," step. "For a men's magazine," step. At the top of the stairs, I turned to see Gilpin looking back at the living room. He snapped too.
"Pop culture?"
he called up as he began climbing.
"What exactly does that entail?"
"Popular culture," I said.
We reached the top of the stairs, Boney waiting for us.
"Movies, TV, music, but, not high arts, nothing highfalutin."
I winced. "Highfalutin? How patronizing. You two bumpkins probably need me to translate my English, educated East Coast into English, Midwest folksy.
Me do some scribbling of stuffs I get in my noggin after watching them moving pictures."
"She loves movies," Gilpin said, gesturing toward Boney.
Boney nodded.
"I do."
"Now I own the bar downtown," I added. I taught a class at the junior college, too, but to add that suddenly felt too needy. I wasn't on a date. Boney was peering into the bathroom, halting me and Gilpin in the hallway.
"The bar?" she said. "I know the place. Been meaning to drop by. Love the name. Very meta."
"Sounds like a smart move," Gilpin said.
Boney made for the bedroom, and we followed.
"A life surrounded by beer ain't too bad."
"Sometimes the answer is at the bottom of a bottle," I said,
then winced again at the inappropriateness.
We entered the bedroom.
Gilpin laughed. Don't I know that feeling?
See how the iron is still on? I began.
Boney nodded, opened the door of our roomy closet, and walked inside, flipping on the light, fluttering her latexed hands over shirts and dresses as she moved toward the back. She made a sudden noise, bent down, turned around, holding a perfectly square box covered in elaborate silver wrapping. My stomach seized.
Someone's birthday? She asked.
It's our anniversary.
Boney and Gilpin both twitched like spiders and pretended they didn't. By the time we returned to the living room, the kid officers were gone. Gilpin got down on his knees, eyeing the overturned ottoman.
I'm a little freaked out, obviously, I started.
I don't blame you at all, Nick, Gilpin said earnestly.
He had pale blue eyes that jittered in place, an unnerving tick.
Can we do something? To find my wife? I mean, because she's clearly not here.
Boney pointed at the wedding portrait on the wall, me and my tux, a block of teeth frozen on my face, my arms curved formally around Amy's waist. Amy, her blonde hair tightly coiled and sprayed, her veil blowing in the beach breeze of Cape Cod, her eyes open too wide because she always blinked at the last minute, and she was trying so hard not to blink. The day after Independence Day, the sulfur from the fireworks mingling with the ocean salt. Summer. The Cape had been good to us. I remember discovering several months in that Amy, my girlfriend, was also quite wealthy, a treasured only child of creative genius parents, an icon of sorts thanks to a namesake book series that I thought I could remember as a kid. Amazing Amy. Amy explained this to me in calm, measured tones, as if I were a patient waking from a coma. As if she'd had to do it too many times before, and it had gone badly. The admission of wealth that's greeted with too much enthusiasm, the disclosure of a secret identity that she herself didn't create. Amy told me who and what she was, and then we went out to the Elliots' historically registered home on Nantucket Sound, went sailing together, and I thought, I am a boy from Missouri, flying across the ocean with people who've seen much more than I have. If I began seeing things now, living big, I could still not catch up with them. It didn't make me feel jealous. It made me feel content. I never aspired to wealth or fame. I was not raised by big dreamer parents who pictured their child as a future president. I was raised by pragmatic parents who pictured their child as a future office worker of some sort, making a living of some sort. To me, it was heady enough to be in the Elliots' proximity, to skim across the Atlantic and return to a plushly restored home built in 1822 by a whaling captain, and there to prepare and eat meals of organic, healthful foods whose names I didn't know how to pronounce. Quinoa. I remember thinking quinoa was a kind of fish. So we married on the beach on a deep blue summer day, ate and drank under a white tent that billowed like a sail, and a few hours in, I sneaked Amy off into the dark, toward the waves, because I was feeling so unreal, I believed I had become merely a shimmer. The chilly mist on my skin pulled me back, Amy pulled me back, toward the golden glow of the tent, where the gods were feasting, everything ambrosia. Our whole courtship was just like that. Boney leaned in to examine Amy.
Your wife is very pretty.
She is. She's beautiful, I said, and felt my stomach lilt.
What anniversary today? She asked.
5. I was jittering from one foot to another, wanting to do something. I didn't want them to discuss how lovely my wife was. I wanted them to go out and search for my fucking wife. I didn't say this out loud, though. I often don't say things out loud, even when I should. I contain and compartmentalize to a disturbing degree. In my belly basement are hundreds of bottles of rage, despair, fear, but you'd never guess from looking at me.
5. Big one. Let me guess, reservations at Houston's? Gilpin asked.
It was the only upscale restaurant in town. You all really need to try Houston's, my mom had said when we moved back, thinking it was Carthage's unique little secret, hoping it might please my wife.
Of course, Houston's.
It was my 5th lie to the police. I was just starting.
Amy Elliott Dunn, July 5th, 2008. Diary entry. I am fat with love, husky with ardor, morbidly obese with devotion, a happy, busy bumblebee of marital enthusiasm. I positively hum around him, fussing and fixing. I have become a strange thing. I have become a wife. I find myself steering the ship of conversations, bulkily, unnaturally, just so I can say his name aloud. I have become a wife. I have become a bore. I have been asked to forfeit my independent young feminist card. I don't care. I balance his checkbook. I trim his hair. I've gotten so retro, at one point I will probably use the word pocketbook, shuffling out the door in my swingy tweed coat, my lips painted red, on the way to the beauty parlor. Nothing bothers me. Everything seems like it will turn out fine. Every bother transformed into an amusing story to be told over dinner. So, I killed a hobo today, honey. Ha ha ha. Ah, we have fun. Nick is like a good stiff drink. He gives everything the correct perspective. Not a different perspective, the correct perspective. With Nick, I realize it actually, truly, doesn't matter if the electricity bill is a few days late, if my latest quiz turns out a little lame. My most recent, I'm not joking. What kind of tree would you be? Me? I'm an apple tree. This means nothing. It doesn't matter if the new Amazing Amy book has been well and duly scorched, the reviews vicious, the sales a stunning plummet after a limp start. It doesn't matter what color I paint our room, or how late traffic makes me, or whether our recycling really, truly does get recycled. Just level with me, New York, does it? It doesn't matter, because I have found my match. It's Nick, laid back and calm, smart and fun and uncomplicated, untortured, happy, nice, big penis. All the stuff I don't like about myself has been pushed to the back of my brain. Maybe that is what I like best about him, the way he makes me. Not makes me feel, just makes me. I am fun. I am playful. I am game. I feel naturally happy and entirely satisfied. I am a wife. It's weird to say those words. Seriously, about the recycling, New York? Come on, just a wink. We do silly things, like last weekend we drove to Delaware because neither of us have ever had sex in Delaware. Let me set the scene, because now it really is for posterity. We cross the state line. Welcome to Delaware, the sign says, and also, small wonder, and also, the first state, and also, Home of tax-free shopping. Delaware, a state of many rich identities. I point Nick down the first dirt road I see, and we rumble 5 minutes until we hit pine trees on all sides. We don't speak. He pushes his seat back. I pull up my skirt. I am not wearing undies. I can see his mouth turn down and his face go slack, the drugged, determined look he gets when he's turned on. I climb atop him, my back to him, facing the windshield. I'm pressed against the steering wheel, and as we move together, the horn emits tiny bleats that mimic me, and my hand makes a smearing noise as I press it against the windshield. Nick and I can come anywhere. Neither of us get stage fright. It's something we're both rather proud of. Then, we drive right back home. I eat beef jerky and ride with bare feet on the dashboard. We love our house. The house that Amazing Amy built. A Brooklyn brownstone my parents bought for us, right on the promenade with the big widescreen view of Manhattan. It's extravagant. It makes me feel guilty, but it's perfect. I battle the spoiled rich girl vibe where I can. Lots of DIY. We painted the walls ourselves over 2 weekends. Spring green and pale yellow and velvety blue. In theory. None of the colors turned out like we thought they would, but we pretend to like them anyway. We fill our home with knickknacks from flea markets. We buy records for Nick's record player. Last night, we sat on the old Persian rug, drinking wine and listening to the vinyl scratches as the sky went dark and Manhattan switched on, and Nick said, "This is how I always pictured it. This is exactly how I pictured it." On weekends, we talk to each other under 4 layers of bedding, our faces warm under a sunlit yellow comforter. Even the floorboards are cheerful. There are 2 old creaky slats that call out to us as we walk in the door. I love it. I love that it is ours, that we have a great story behind the ancient floor lamp or the misshapen clay mug that sits near our coffee pot, never holding anything but a single paperclip. I spend my days thinking of sweet things to do for him. Go buy a peppermint soap that will sit in his palm like a warm stone. Or maybe a slim slice of trout that I could cook and serve to him, an ode to his riverboat days. I know, I am ridiculous. I love it, though. I never knew I was capable of being ridiculous over a man. It's a relief. I even swoon over his socks, which he manages to shed in adorably tangled poses, as if a puppy carried them in from another room. It is our 1-year anniversary, and I am fat with love. Even though people kept telling and telling us the first year was going to be so hard, as if we were naive children marching off to war. It wasn't hard. We are meant to be married. It is our 1-year anniversary, and Nick is leaving work at lunchtime. My treasure hunt awaits him. The clues are all about us, about the past year together. Whenever my sweet hubby gets a cold, it is this dish that will soon be sold. Answer: the Tom Yum soup from Thai Town on President Street. The manager will be there this afternoon with a taster bowl and the next clue. Also, McMahon's in Chinatown and the Alice statue at Central Park. A grand tour of New York. We'll end at the Fulton Street Fish Market, where we'll buy a pair of beautiful lobsters, and I will hold the container in my lap as Nick jitters nervously in the cab beside me. We'll rush home, and I will drop them in a new pot on our old stove with all the finesse of a girl who has lived many Cape summers, while Nick giggles and pretends to hide in fear outside the kitchen door. I had suggested we get burgers. Nick wanted us to go out. 5-star, fancy. Somewhere with a clockwork of courses and name-dropping waiters. So the lobsters are a perfect in-between. The lobsters are what everyone tells us, and tells us, and tells us, that marriage is about. compromise. We'll eat lobster with butter and have sex on the floor while a woman on one of our old jazz records sings to us in her far side of the tunnel voice. We'll get slowly, lazy drunk on good scotch, Nick's favorite. I'll give him his present, the monogrammed stationery he's been wanting from Crane and Company, with the clean sans-serif font set in hunter green on the thick, creamy stock that will hold lush ink and his writer's words. Stationery for a writer, and a writer's wife who's maybe angling for a love letter or two. Then maybe we'll have sex again, and a late-night burger, and more scotch. Voila! Happiest couple on the block. And they say marriage is such hard work.
Nick Dunn, The Night Of. Boney and Gilpin moved our interview to the police station, which looks like a failing community bank. They left me alone in a little room for 40 minutes, me willing myself not to move. To pretend to be calm is to be calm, in a way. I slouched over the table, put my chin on my arm, waited. "Do you want to call Amy's parents?" Boney had asked. "I don't want to panic them," I said. "If we don't hear from her in an hour, I'll call." We'd done 3 rounds of that conversation. Finally, the cops came in and sat at the table across from me. I fought the urge to laugh at how much it felt like a TV show. This was the same room I'd seen surfing through late-night cable for the past 10 years, and the 2 cops, weary, intense, acted like the stars. Totally fake. Epcot Police Station. Boney was even holding a paper coffee cup and a manila folder that looked like a prop. Cop prop. I felt giddy. Felt for a moment we were all pretend people. Let's play the missing wife game.
"You okay there, Nick?" Boney asked.
"I'm okay. Why?"
"You're smiling."
The giddiness slid to the tiled floor. "I'm sorry. It's all just..."
"I know," Boney said, giving me a look that was like a hand pat. "It's too strange, I know."
She cleared her throat.
"First of all, we want to make sure you're comfortable here. You need anything, just let us know. The more information you can give us right now, the better. But you can leave at any time, that's not a problem either."
"Whatever you need."
"Okay, great. Thank you," she said. Okay. I want to get the annoying stuff out of the way first. The crap stuff. If your wife was indeed abducted, and we don't know that, but if it comes to that, we want to catch the guy. And when we catch the guy, we want to nail him. Hard. No way out. No wiggle room."
"Right.
So we have to rule you out real quick, real easy. So the guy can't come back and say we didn't rule you out. You know what I mean?"
I nodded mechanically. I didn't really know what she meant, but I wanted to seem as cooperative as possible. "Whatever you need."
"We don't want to freak you out," Gilpin added. "We just want to cover all the bases."
"Fine by me." It's always the husband, I thought. Everyone knows it's always the husband, so why can't they just say it? "We suspect you because you are the husband, and it's always the husband. Just watch Dateline."
"Okay, great, Nick," Boney said. "First, let's get a swab of the inside of your cheek so we can rule out all of the DNA in the house that isn't yours. Would that be okay?"
"Sure."
"I'd also like to take a quick sweep of your hands for gunshot residue. Again, just in case."
Wait. "Have you found something that makes you think my wife was..."
No, Nick, Gilpin interrupted.
He pulled a chair up to the table and sat on it backward. I wondered if cops actually did that. Or did some clever actor do that, and then cops began doing it because they'd seen the actors playing cops do that, and it looked cool.
It's just smart protocol, Gilpin continued. We try to cover every base. Check your hands, get a swab, and if we could, check out your car, too.
Of course. Like I said, whatever you need.
Thank you, Nick. I really appreciate it. Sometimes, guys, they make things hard for us, just because they can.
I was exactly the opposite. My father had infused my childhood with unspoken blame. He was the kind of man who skulked around looking for things to be angry at. This had turned Go defensive and extremely unlikely to take unwarranted shit. It had turned me into a knee-jerk suck-up to authority. Mom, Dad, teachers, whatever makes your job easier, sir or madam. I craved a constant stream of approval. You'd literally lie, cheat, and steal, hell, kill, to convince people you're a good guy, Go once said.
We were in line for knishes at Yonah Schimmel's, not far from Go's old New York apartment. That's how well I remember the moment. And I lost my appetite, because it was so completely true and I'd never realized it. And even as she was saying it, I thought, I will never forget this. This is one of those moments that will be lodged in my brain forever.
We made small talk, the cops and I, about the July 4th fireworks and the weather, while my hands were tested for gunshot residue and the slick inside of my cheek was cotton-tipped. Pretending it was normal. A trip to the dentist. When it was done, Boney put another cup of coffee in front of me, squeezed my shoulder.
I'm sorry about that. Worst part of the job. You think you're up to a few questions now? It'd really help us.
Yes, definitely. Fire away. She placed the slim digital tape recorder on the table in front of me.
You mind? This way you won't have to answer the same questions over and over and over.
She wanted to tape me so I'd be nailed to one story. I should call a lawyer, I thought. But only guilty people need lawyers. So I nodded. No problem.
So, Amy, Boney said. You two been living here how long?
Just about 2 years.
And she's originally from New York City?
Yes.
She work? Got a job? Gilpin said.
No, she used to write personality quizzes. The detectives swapped a look.
Quizzes?
For teen magazines, women's magazines, I said. You know, are you the jealous type? Take our quiz and find out. Do guys find you too intimidating? Take our quiz and find out.
Very cool. I love those, Boney said. I didn't know that was an actual job, writing those. Like, a career.
Well, it's not. Anymore. The internet is packed with quizzes for free. Amy's were smarter. She had a master's in psychology. Has a master's in psychology. I guffawed uncomfortably at my gaffe.
But smart can't beat free. Then what?
I shrugged. Then we moved back here. She's just kind of staying at home right now.
Oh! You guys got kids then?
Boney chirped, as if she had discovered good news.
No. Oh. So then, what does she do most days?
That was my question, too. Amy once was a woman who did a little of everything, all the time. When we moved in together, she'd made an intense study of French cooking displaying hyper-quick knife skills and an inspired Berfbergian yawn.